CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers. Lee, let's introduce our sponsors.
Sure. Today's show is brought to you by Delaney Consulting LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney as outstanding and excellent. Also, SAP Business by Design, a fully integrated business management software solution designed for small to mid-sized companies that want the benefits of large-scale business applications without the need for a large IT infrastructure. And Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
This week's CFO Radio News. Earlier this year, Compliance Week reported Financial Executives International sent a letter to the Financial Accounting Standards Board, FASB, and the International Accounting Standards Board, IASB, suggesting the two boards slow down things in their breakneck effort to eliminate major differences between the U.S. and international accounting rules. The two boards are moving very swiftly to achieve a target date and to adopt nearly a dozen new accounting standards that would lead to a greater convergence of the U.S. generally accepted accounting principles and the International Financial Reporting Standards, known as IFRS. Arnold Hainisch, chairman of FEI's Committee on Corporate Reporting, said in his letter to the two boards that the group is concerned about the unprecedented volume as well as the complexity of the new proposed standards, and that the two boards are developing. Hainisch called on the boards to consider having no more than 3 to 4 proposals at any given time to give more time for a thorough analysis. In his letter, Hainisch says the member companies of the Committee on Corporate Reporting are extremely concerned. During any single period in its time, in 38 years of history, FASB has had no more than 3 or 4 significant EDs out for a public comment. As an example, he says the proposal to rewrite how financial statements are presented will dictate what information preparers must gather under other other standards are also changing. Similar overlap exists with proposals on revenue recognition, on leases, and with liabilities and financial instruments. Hainisch said that the committee doubts there are adequate technical resources available in the industry to study and react to quite so many proposals at one time, and that they doubt FASB or IASB has the resources to fully study the feedback and possible consequences of all of the proposals as well. I'm sure we'll follow more regarding the convergence with the ISSB, but that is a good lead into our guest today, Ray Hutton, who joins us. Welcome to the show, Ray.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Ray, you are the Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Turner Broadcasting System International, a Time Warner company, which is listed as number 131 on the Fortune Companies listing. Many of our guests will be familiar with TBS, groundbreaking network, CNN, one of the world's most respected and trusted resources for news and information. TBS Inc. is also home to familiar entertainment networks such as TBS, TNT, Cartoon Network, Turner Classic Movies, Adult Swim, True TV, and Peach TV. Wow, that took a breath. Well, Ray, that's a lot to manage. In your current role, you oversee the financial and operation accounting and reporting, strategic planning, and acquisitions for all of Turner International's markets. Maybe let's start by, tell us your background. What did you do in your account, your degree, and what was your first couple of roles in the world?
Well, when I was in college, I was actually a financial management major and really knew very little about public accounting and the accounting world. I was more focused on banking and investment banking. And I had a professor my senior year. I had an auditing class I had to take for my major, and turned out to be a great professor, and he encouraged me to talk to the Big Eight firms at the time. And I did, and I met some really good people at Ernst & Young. It was Ernst & Ernst at the time. And said, well, maybe I should do this. So I went into public accounting with Ernst & Ernst and thought I'd get my CPA after a couple of years of experience and move on. But that's not the way it happened. So I stayed there for quite a long time and was about 16 years with Ernst & Ernst. Ernst & Young.
Fabulous. So you are one of our guests that have taken the typical CPA audit path. What did you learn from there in terms of now you are in industry driving the financials? What are some key takeaways that you had?
I think the biggest thing that I learned in public accounting was, number one, from the people I worked with. There's a wealth of knowledge that you get in working with really high-quality people, and the high-quality people I had a chance to work with at Ernst & Young was really great. I learned a lot, and that's one thing I really cherish is learning something new from somebody in each of my experiences. The other thing was the diversity of clients and the diversity of industries that I got the chance to serve and learn a lot about. And I think both of those gave me a broader perspective on financial aspects of businesses, as well as the business operations themselves.
And some of our guests also talk about the fact that they get to see an awful lot of different management styles and can learn what they believe would work well for them and perhaps some areas that they don't think they'd like to adopt.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a couple of people, as I said, that I worked with that I really respected in particular and got to work with a lot, and really gave me a lot to think about as far as my own style of management and leadership. And I did. I adopted not only technical accounting and auditing facets of them, but also their management styles.
Well, do you have any particular advice for somebody that perhaps is maybe still in their teens and looking to be that CFO of the future? Anything that you might suggest for them starting out their career?
Well, I think making that decision whether you want to go into public accounting or straight into industry is a decision to make. I think today there's a lot more people that will actually go back to public accounting, whereas when I was coming along, it was the first point of entry. And so I think there's much more flexibility in changing direction in career to get broader experience. But I think the key is the experience. I think if you go directly into industry, you need to make sure either within the company or outside the company that you get a broad level of experience and not be too narrow in what you learn, especially early in your career. I think in public accounting, it's the same thing. Be exposed to as many industries as possible. There's a lot of need for specialization, but early in your career especially, I think the more you get exposed to, the more then you'll have a chance to understand what you're excited about, what you like, and what drives you.
And with that in mind, there are some companies that are quite notable for having what I would call management training opportunities. Some individuals might start with an internal audit function so that they get the same kind of exposure of different departments, different elements of operations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think internal audit departments, especially ones that are run real well and that are very professionally organized, are a great learning ground for the whole business. You get exposed to different levels of management. You get exposed to different aspects of the operations of the business that you may not just in a financial audit role. And I think it is a great training ground and a great opportunity to get that breadth of experience.
Mm. Well, you've served in some very senior roles at several companies. Tell us about some of the earlier experiences as you moved into industry. What was your first role, and how did some of those earlier roles prepare for you for today?
Well, when I decided that to start looking outside of Ernst & Young, I met a president of a New York apparel manufacturer, and I had a lot of textile and apparel clients in my role in industry. And he was looking for a CFO to help him do a lot of mergers and acquisitions in that industry that he was in particular, which was very fragmented, and there was a lot of small companies but nobody of scale. And so that sounded intriguing to me. The other thing that was intriguing at the time was that his business was not store retailers, but it was all catalog retailers. And catalog retailers becoming internet retailers have essentially the same distribution chain, from a distribution center to delivery to their distribution center, or direct delivery to customers and so forth, as opposed to having to ship to store by store by store and getting beat up by the Walmarts or whoever on its very difficult service model. And so it was interesting that was going to be a chance to see the internet really take off, hopefully.
And had you had any M&A experience prior to that?
Yeah, within Ernst & Young, working on different clients that had do acquisitions or divestitures, yeah.
Wonderful. And one of the things that you had talked about there is certainly the aspects of logistics, warehousing, and time management of that whole logistical exposure. One of the things that I find is that finance folks that have actually come through that level of experiences, because of the inventory aspect of accounting, they have a greater appreciation often of the costing function and the intricacies of what is very often a complex accounting practice.
Yeah, I had a lot of manufacturing clients in my auditing days, and of course this company lived and died on inventory, but I came to the conclusion, as opposed to as an auditor looking at current ratios, that inventory is an asset. Inventory is actually a liability in the manufacturing business because it's eating up cash. And cash management was really the thing that I didn't really understand from my public accounting days, that I learned very quickly in this first role in the industry, that was paramount. And cash management and making sure that we don't have a lot of cash tied up in inventory was a real problem.
And, of course, now today you're with a company that, for the most part, doesn't have any inventory.
Well, the inventory we have today is programming. And so we do spend money on programming, and that does carry, you know, a cost that gets deferred into the future.
Sure, sure. Well, you, as part of your early career within Turner Broadcasting System, you implemented Sarbanes-Oxley at the company. Tell us a little bit about some of those experiences of being, obviously, along with all the other firms, you had to adopt it at that time frame. But what were the challenges, and where are you today with Sarbanes-Oxley?
Yeah, that was really an interesting experience for me. It was an area that the CFO at the time of Turner asked me to take on, and actually it was an interesting challenge. At the time, if people turn back their clocks and think about this, it was really a reactionary time to everything that happened at Enron and so forth. And so everybody was trying to think about these new standards and this new law and how does it apply. And I think everybody went to the lowest level of commonality, which was everything has to be done, you know, on a scale of 10, and that there's no exceptions, and that everything is a problem if it doesn't. It's almost like forensic auditing, that one error is an error. And I kept working with not only our Time Warner corporate folks and our auditors and trying to talk about the risks and the controls, and that you have multiple controls along the pathway, that the risk associated with each control was actually a multiplicity of risks, and you had to fail at many, many points to have really a failure that would rise to a reportable condition or a significant error. So that theory was very hard because the firms were very entrenched in trying to make sure that they did the right thing under the scrutiny that they were in. It was a brand new thing for all of us in the corporate world as well.
And the materiality for you was much lower at that point, I guess.
Yeah, the materiality became almost anything.
Almost nothing,
yeah.
Right.
And so the idea that judgment was ultimately the real thing that mattered in these things, or what level of controls are adequate, was a real difficulty. The reconciliation of judgments between the auditors and us was a very difficult thing, and we had a lot of meetings. And luckily, we have a good audit firm and a good team on our account, and we had a lot of meetings and a lot of planning, and we took a very aggressive, proactive view in developing the whole plan well in advance of, I think, a lot of companies, and I think put together a very good team internally that really addressed a lot of these issues that helped us, I think, lead the way.
So where are you in terms of SOX compliance? Has this become a routine process? Is it now managed by the internal audit function? Talk to us a little bit about operational of that.
Yeah, now it is. Obviously, it's much more routine, and it's much more structured, and it's kind of found its level. And we've got an internal team that's in addition to internal audit that handles that for us. And they've continued to do and progress in the evolution of how to test, how to look at the company, how to find where the key controls really are and what the risk areas really are. So I think it's evolved after those first couple of years into one that is much more predictable and much more stable and much more structured of an approach. And we've got a very good team doing that.
And in the elements of materiality, has that still now 0.01 of a penny, or has that gone up a little?
Well, I think it's gone up a little, but it's less around the dollar amounts today, other than trying to identify those accounts and processes that are significant, and more about what are the controls and are those controls providing reasonable assurance that the operations are going to occur and the reporting is going to occur as expected.
Well, in terms of reporting, our earlier news section talked about the U.S. facing some IFRS international convergence. As a leader of the international operations over the finance, what impact do you think that this is going to have? Perhaps let's start with companies in general. I don't want to ask you to say anything that would open up any confidentiality. But for international businesses, what do you think the impact's going to be?
Well, I think a lot of companies that are working internationally today are dealing with local statutory requirements. A lot of countries have not adopted IFRS, even though it's talked about as the international standards. So we still have a lot of statutory gap in any particular country. Then you do have some IFRS adoptive countries, and then you have, of course, U.S. GAAP. And so a country that reports in the U.S. that has to report U.S. GAAP has to kind of work through all three of those. It's not just a one-to-one. It's a 1-2-3. And it does provide some logistical, but really the people that do that and our people and other people in that have similar situations where they're multi-territory, I think have the resources today to be able to do that. I think the question is going to be the proliferation of GAAP, whether it's U.S. GAAP or international GAAP, that is really the issue. It's the complexity and the volume of standards, and the conversation has been around being more principles-based internationally, but then you look at some of the standards and the way they talk about it, and it's not as principles-based, but it still leaves you to a lot of judgment. And I came along when you used your judgment anyway, and I think the rules have provided less clarity and more volatility in reporting today.
And certainly the rule books have got thicker and thicker and thicker. Over time, there have been more detailed elements. I mean, I remember when SAB 101 came in and then SAB 104 and, trying to scratch your head and look at multiple contracts with the same customer. That was a massive challenge way back then. Well, now look where we are, and certainly goodwill, leases, some of the big elements of that intangibles that in an IFRS world versus the U.S. GAAP. Do you think we'll actually go into adopting IFRS in the States?
You know, I don't know. I've been to several conferences where you've heard, you know, both sides of the equation, and some people say, well, the SEC is committed to and it's going to happen and so forth. I think the question is still very open. I don't know that we'll actually get to a convergent state that is truly convergent, and that leaves issuers and registrants here in the U.S. to have to either provide reconciliation or the SEC to allow some other reporting standard. I think personally that it's much more around the analysts and the users of the financial statements, and that's where the focus really should be. And I think we've locked ourselves in, both at the FASB and the SEC, into too much of a theoretical bubble, and really should be thinking about what's really informative. And I think where measurement and things like that around fair value have become very hot topics, the actuality of that is that people make their own judgments about that. And just because you calculate it and report it and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to calculate it doesn't make it right. And I think if you have good disclosure about it, then people can make their judgments. So I think, to me, the key is better disclosure of the actuality of your positions and your transactions than it is this idea of there's a perfect measurement principle.
You know, it's interesting. I think it was December, January timeframe, through the FEI, Financial Executive International, I was part of an analytical team that was looking at the management discussion and analysis and the level of detail that's coming back up. The level of detail and the level of disclosure is often looked at, re-looked at, and making sure that not only is the requests for detail too much, but the requests for detail, are they enough? And trying to get an understanding of balance. Very candidly, companies and their legal departments will pretty much put in what they have to. There's not a whole lot of fluff or additional on top of that. You don't want to tell your competition. And in today's environment, sometimes that information is competitive and companies may even decline to actually put it in their financials and their annual report. So how do you balance that level of, let's say, well, where we are today, absent the IFRS, how do you balance what level of detail to put in versus what level of detail not to?
Well, now you're getting, you know, this is strictly Ray Hutton speaking. This is not speaking on behalf of Time Warner. But in my estimation as a CPA and a professional that's held to these standards, that I think you have to disclose what is appropriate for the reader of the financial statements. Now, I think one of the big areas that people have had concern with is forward-looking information, is also information around commitments and contingencies that may be competitive, or, you know, lawsuits or things like that. We've talked about the requirements under the tax rules now about disclosing certain things to the IRS, and all these things lead to real problems for business making judgments around what is the appropriate amount and what amount should they just not disclose. I think at the end of the day, you really want to stand back and say, you know, what is the right information to disclose? And I think the attorneys, the CFO and the accounting staff, as well as the executive management, really just need to sit down and have an honest evaluation of that, because nothing good leads from trying to circumvent the disclosures. It's a snowball that is not, it's going to get out of hand. So you just need to, if there's something that you're concerned about, it's better to get it out there and get it out there quickly and manage it.
And what about the small business? 99.7%, I'm quoting a statistic from the Small Business Administration, 99.7% of businesses, of employers, are less than 500 employee based companies. I've talked on the topics of AS5 and the impact of Sarbanes-Oxley on the small company and internal controls. There has been some trickle down in a post Sarbanes-Oxley. Do you think that potentially there's going to be more trickle down? Certainly revenue recognition is becoming much, much more complex.
It is. I think the question is there big gap and little gap? And is there a separate standard? Of course, when the SEC came out with the small business standards and tried to make the reporting for smaller registrants easier several years ago, I think that was a good move, and I think it was a recognition as there is two different markets, really. And I think from a GAAP perspective, from a non-registrant perspective, the small company perspective, the AICPA really has an opportunity to step up here. And not only on the auditing standard side, which they do still have responsibility for, but having greater influence around the FASB and the GAAP side of this, because I do think it doesn't make sense to try to put everybody in one basket. And I think it's an overburdensome to small companies. It increases fees for no real value to their bankers or their creditors or their shareholders. And again, I think if you go back to what's the right thing to disclose, if you have experienced accountants and experienced auditors and experienced financial advisors, they're going to know inherently what is the right thing to disclose. And the old GAAP checklist that we used to use when it was, you know, 100 pages, now I guess everything's electronic today that you can't even get it into a book. But it's just gotten too complex that the readers of the financials can't understand it, analysts can't understand it, and they discount a lot of what the accounting world puts in there and do their own analysis.
One area that I used to get a lot involved in was the pension footnote, and the forward-looking statements just, it becomes so complicated that almost you've got to be a technical or forensics SEC expert to be able to understand it.
Yeah, it has, and the whole idea of the average reader understanding mortality tables and discount rates and future growth rates and things like that, it's just not there. I think the idea that we do have a pension liability out there that's an unfunded liability, and people can understand that, but the variables and the sensitivity of those variables is very high, and so it makes that questionable as to the value of that disclosure.
Got to wonder whether the average Joe who's about to buy a couple of shares on the stock market even would go to look at the financials. Maybe somebody just said it's a buy.
I don't think many brokers understand or look at the financials. I think the financials are probably looked at, you know, from an investor and a mutual fund. I'm sure there's people that do their due diligence and the fund managers and the analysts, but at the end of the day, I don't think it's probably not 50% of the amount of the information that's disclosed is really valued to them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, keeps people busy, and certainly keeps the auditors busy, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the key challenges in your role today with a publicly held company as CFO, and you're in the international environment. What are the key challenges? Is it the human capital? Is it the financial capital? Is it governments? Or is it something else? As you expand to those other international markets, what are your challenges?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about the international business landscape is that it's so dynamic and so diverse. You do have a lot of challenges with different governments and regulations and so forth. As I talked about from an accounting and finance perspective, we have statutory filing requirements and so forth. I think just as far as in the business environment, there are a lot of rules and regulations around all businesses as to what they can and can't do, foreign ownership restrictions, things like that that make planning and thinking about it, tax treaties, tax transfer pricing. There's a lot of those things that go into the mix, probably not as a primary driver to making decisions around those things, but certainly an area that you want to plan for and manage to make sure you maximize any investments and any activities that you have in foreign markets. I think as far as the human capital, one of the things that I'm very fortunate at is that our folks at Turner International are just great. I've not met a person in any of our regions that I just don't see that are excited about the business, excited about being there on the finance or the operational side. And I just have really enjoyed traveling and spending time and meeting, because I learn. Every time I travel, I learn something from somebody, and that's one of the things that really keeps me going.
What about the cultural aspects of bringing two companies together? I mean, certainly in due diligence, you try your best to look at aspects of all the financial, the human capital, and so forth. And number one, you've got to make sure that you're going into a country and you can remove the cash, that you don't have any kind of restrictions on bringing the funds back to the parent. But what about the culture? How do you look for that? How do you integrate that?
I think the key to that is to have people on the ground that understand that. Either if you're not in that market in a way already, I think you should have good advisors that really understand the market, so you do know what the implications of transitioning from one culture to another. I think the human transition and human integration of a merger of any business is probably the one that is the most critical and the least done well. And I think anybody would be well advised to make sure that they don't think they can do it internally if they really don't have the staffing and the expertise to do that, to look for outside advisors, because if you're spending millions of dollars on an acquisition and you don't want to spend $100,000 on some assistance in the human integration parts of it, whether it's benefit programs, whether it's titles and salary ranges, whether it's just the whole idea of understanding how a company in another country understands everything from FCPA to statutory SEC filing requirements and deadlines and quick closes and things like that, where they may not have done that in the past. So there is an expectation gap, or at least a perception gap, probably, that you don't realize going into that, and really finding people close to the market, whether you have them in your company or you find them outside, to understand what those implications are is an important first step.
And when you acquire companies, again, I'm not asking for any confidential information. Maybe let's talk it about this broadly, generally. There clearly is a difference between acquiring a company that is in that country publicly traded. They perhaps are used to regulation reporting. I think all companies have government tax reporting, so that aside. But let's say you're acquiring some privately held companies. They may have a couple of owners. The financials may arrive when the owner wants to have a look at them. Cash flow may just be a personal bank account for the use of the owners, personal expenses going through. Is there cultural aspects of the executive trying to incorporate and converge those into your own organization and your own expectations?
Yeah, I think so. I think quite frankly, that's part of what you should be evaluating heavily in the due diligence. I think when you look at a target company, you need to look at the people and what you think are the keys to the, why you're acquiring that company. If executive management is one of the keys and you want that management because they're really the ones that drove it. And so therefore you have to balance out what made them successful and then integrating them into a company that may be more structured and may have more requirements that they're not used to. That's part of that conversation other than price. I think getting that on the table in the negotiations so that they clearly understand and you clearly understand what the gaps are and how those gaps might or might not be bridged, because I really think the key is if you don't think you can make that bridge, don't do the deal.
Interestingly enough, you mentioned a little earlier in terms of you can do valuations to statistics and run tables, but the value really is, I kind of take from your words, whatever the purchaser is wanting to pay is the value, right? You can say 10 billion or 10 million, but if the purchaser doesn't want to pay but half that, that's the value.
Yeah, and maybe from the seller's perspective, they're just not going to do that. So that's part of the financial aspects of this, but I really do think there is a good piece of most deals that get made or broken on the cultural fit. And I think people either hit it off or they don't hit it off. And unless somebody's actually selling because they have to or there's something, if you're in not a takeover fight or not a distressed sale, but you're actually in a arm's length negotiation with somebody, I think without having that cultural fit and an understanding of how the seller will either continue or not continue, but how the company and the human capital in that company are going to integrate, without that understanding and without a good eyes wide open perspective on that, you're doomed for a real rocky road if you do the deal.
Just for purposes of listeners to the radio show, can you tell us in terms of countries that over the last couple of years that you've been into to acquire that is public information, which countries or continents have you already made those acquisitions?
We have done a deal in Latin America. We've done one in Northern Europe. And we've done some in Asia, so we've kind of been in each of our three major regions.
And I've got to assume with the reach that certainly your company has, very internationally, you've got a lot of literally local people on the street. You're reporting virtually on every street, every country in the world. You probably have some pretty good tapped markets to be able to identify what company you might like to acquire. Do you start that by looking at which countries that you'd like to go into and then do a deep dive within that region?
I think that's one of the questions of philosophy of approaching acquisitions. Do you start with key markets that you're looking at where you want to have or already have a significant presence or want to drive additional scale? Or do you look at the core of what you're wanting to grow from a target audience, in our case, or from a product line or something like that? So I think you have to decide and not just be out there sniffing deals and say, oh, here's a deal. You need to make sure it follows your strategy, and you need to be clear of what your strategy is. If your strategy is to grow across a particular product line, then that should be your strategy. If your strategy is to be grow in certain key markets, say the BRIC countries, and you really want to be participating in what the anticipated growth of Brazil, Russia, India, and China is in the future, then that should be your strategy. But you still have to make sure that it fits with your business. And if you're just being a financial buyer or a holding company, that's one thing. If you're being Warren Buffett and you're going to buy management, you're going to buy the company. But if you're really buying a strategic relationship, you have to really understand what your strategy is and not go from flower to flower without really having some discipline.
Yeah, I liked what Warren said. It might have been 8, 10, 12 months ago that why did he buy one of the acquisitions last year? And he said, well, when I was a kid, I always liked playing with trains, and now I have real ones to play with.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's much more of a strategy to that.
There is, I'm sure, but most companies are not in that position.
No, certainly. Well, let's talk a little bit about the organization and the workforce. We've talked about culture. We've talked about bringing those together. The U.S. is still experiencing some pretty hard times. Has this had an impact on you in terms of available resources and or funding for a growing organization? You're acquiring, you're growing, you're going into new markets. Has any of this had any impact on you?
Well, I think the availability of resources is always a concern in that you really have, especially from my perspective sitting here in Atlanta, I really rely heavily on our regional finance leads and our regional HR folks to identify those resources. What we have to do is set forth a strategy and a criteria on which we really, where we want from a financial perspective, where we want and what are the kind of underlying standards from a talent acquisition perspective. And then when the market is good, in particular in, say, London, there's been a lot of turnover in London, and people are very easily moving around, and that's slowed down, obviously, with the recession, but that's just a market that seems to be more dynamic as far as people moving from position to position, whereas in Hong Kong, for instance, it's not. It's not as volatile. So I think there is a dynamic in each market, and it gets back to kind of that culture. Is there a loyalty and people stay with companies, or is there this idea that I need for my career to move, you know, every couple of years? So I think you have to be aware of that as you're trying to develop a team and so forth.
And, of course, the Gen X, Gen Y, and now the Millennium babies, they're getting a pretty bad rap on that. And there's a lot of human capital presentations and statistics that say, well, hey, their parents got laid off in their 40s. Why should they be loyal? And so there's a lot of dynamics going on to the new workforce entrant.
I think there is, and I think at the end of the day, it's probably less about loyalty to the company and a pension plan and those things, because those things are not the things that are there today. I think the challenge for us is to provide an environment that is challenging and invigorating and exciting, as exciting as it can be in some of the accounting world. But really, what I try to do is I try to get people to think about the opportunity to learn something new, the opportunity to expand, the opportunity to stretch themselves, and to look for those opportunities and ask for those opportunities because, you know, over my career, I've had a lot of different opportunities to do that. And irrespective of whether I liked the company or liked my boss or whatever, if I had an opportunity to do something new and learn, and as long as I was learning, I was feel like I was doing well. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with career advancement and title or anything else. That's where I get back to what I talked about first thing was, I think, broad experience. It's what you take away. And how you feel about yourself is what you should be loyal to. And if you can do that within a company, then that's a good thing.
Interestingly enough, a lot of CFOs and CEOs today are doing some very unique things to teach them how to motivate other people. C-level executives are in mass force, I hear. Perhaps that's a little bit of promotion from the places that they go to, but doing comedy school to learn about the tomatoes, eggs being thrown at them and all that sort of stuff, and be able to combat that kind of situation, because today's CFO is very much in the public eye. You're the first one that's going to have the handcuffs on you, and you're also the
that's not a good thing to say.
No, but you're also the person in the organization. You're at the top, and you've got a lot of people that are highly professional looking up to you as the leader of the organization. Now, that being said, let's briefly, if we can, talk a little bit about leadership in finance. You can't get across the conversation without talking something about information and systems and data. What do you do within your company to help with the acquisitions and your international development? What is your strategy in terms of should a company be part of, include as part of their due diligence, the implementation of your system, the adoption onto your chart of accounts, all that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, that's obviously part of that due diligence for us is very critical, not only the financial aspects of operating systems, but also the non-financial systems, as well as the basic infrastructure, everything from email, you know, and those kinds of things. And it is very important to think about, and it's very important to think about, too, whether your ERP or your standard, that whatever you're using for your general ledger and other financials, is even applicable in a country. We have a lot of requirements in each of these countries around statutory reporting, and most countries have very specific packages, or there's vendors out there that have very specific packages for that country, that it doesn't necessarily make sense to try to take them off of that and then have to retrofit statutory reporting. So I think one of the opportunities is to really understand that people have talked about, well, we want to be on one chart of accounts, one system worldwide, but what does that really mean, and is that a benchmark that's worth pursuing? In a lot of cases, we've taken the position that what we can do is we can align through mapping exercise the chart of accounts to make sure we are getting the right standards, that the policies and procedures are still followed, but that they can still use their local system to make their statutory reporting requirements in the year-end audit very easy. By the same token, we can still upload data very quickly and consistently into our general ledger system. And so I think you have to make a well-informed decision as to that. I think you'll hear people say, one system, and companies that do that, there are a lot of companies, Oracle or whoever, that, you know, as soon as they buy a company, you're on, and that's the way it's going to work. And I think that's, again, the philosophy of from the top down versus the bottom up versus some balance in between. It gets back to your strategy and your philosophy around the corporate structures.
Mm-hmm. And that might go back to a lot of education and change for those newly acquired finance team, the information systems teams. They need to be able to adapt and learn. So there's got to be some time frame in there to teach, train, and nurture that within them.
Yeah, and if you make a lot of changes, obviously change in a financial reporting system, again, going back to Sarbanes-Oxley, you've introduced a new variable that has a risk associated with it. So you have to manage that variable. And so it may be that you take a slower time to make sure that the training and the transition can happen appropriately and that the controls along the way do not lose their effectiveness.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about making an acquisition in Latin America. I think my first acquisition in Mexico, when I went down there long time ago, they didn't actually the company that I went to didn't actually use double entry reporting. And my first time in Russia, the company that you were auditing might have made a sale for X million, and the guy went to collect the cash, which often you actually have guys that go collect the cash in Russia and Africa, and instead of being given a suitcase full of cash, that he pointed at some kind of ferry the other side that was full of 100,000 bushels of wheat, and now they're a wheat trader, and they didn't know that. Very, very unique. When you start going across some of these international areas, you don't even know what you're going to get. And certainly as an auditor, I had no idea how to value a ferry full of a ship full of wheat. Very unique, very interesting experience.
Yeah, luckily I haven't run into those kinds of things. That really does become a challenge, especially if you're an auditor. But I think, again, getting back to from an acquisitions perspective, or even a joint venture, if you're trying to do a joint venture with a company in a country, really understanding what they are doing and what their strengths and weaknesses are before you get into a relationship with them is very important.
Yeah. Well, Ray, while I hate to break off the fabulous conversation, we have come to the end of the show. But we have one final question. We've got a tradition on the show to ask your CFO tip of the month. What is yours?
Tip of the month.
Go watch CNN.
Yeah, watch CNN. That's right. We started out with kind of that personal, development and what people should think about. I think one of the things that I do is I have my CPA certificate, as faded as it is, still on my wall in my office. And that's as a reminder to me, and I share this with people I interview for jobs and so forth, is I have that up there because I look at it and it says Raymond F. Hutton. It doesn't say Ernst & Young. It doesn't say Turner Broadcasting. It says Raymond F. Hutton. And that reminds me that I'm responsible for my actions and for my integrity, not somebody else. I've not abdicated my responsibility to the company by being an employee of the company. And so that's a constant reminder to me that I've got to be loyal to myself and I've got to be true to myself first. And so I would use that as a tip that don't let circumstances or situations drive you away from your value system.
Well, that is really a great tip. Certainly ethics, doing the right thing, transparency is very, very big on the CFO agenda, and clearly it's very big on the Ray F. Hutton agenda. Well, thank you very much to Ray Hutton, our guest today, for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO. Thank you also to our contributors. The COSO report that we read earlier from Financial Executive International. Thank you to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune thousands and small businesses alike. For more information, go to DelaneyLLC.com. Thank you to Business by Design, the software as a service business management solution for small and medium-sized companies. For more information on the product, go to SAP.com. And last but not least, Financial Executives International, International, the preeminent association for CFOs and financial executives. Their website is financialexecutives.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at CFOradio.com. If you are a CFO and you'd like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. And thank you very much to our listeners for listening into CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.